Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, a dean of social sciences and a Dominican sheds light on Pope Benedict's social encyclical Caritas in Veritate. Promoter of the cause for beatification of John Henry Newman tells about the miracle attributed to this most famous Englishman. And to mark the feast of Saint Benedict, we join our popular Latin lover as he takes us back in time to the beginning of the Holy Father's pontificate. But first, the latest from the Vatican, where in the afternoon of Friday 10th of July, Pope Benedict XVI received in audience the President of the United States, Barack Obama. Prior to this audience, the President also met with the Vatican's Secretary of State, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, and the Vatican's Secretary for Relations with States, Archbishop Dominique Mamberti. During their cordial exchanges, the conversation turned first of all to questions which are in the interest of all and which constitute a great challenge for the future of every nation and for the true progress of peoples, such as the defence and promotion of life and the right to abide by one's conscience. Reference was also made to immigration, with particular attention to the matter of reuniting families. The meeting also focused upon matters pertaining to international politics, especially in light of the outcome of the G8 summit, which has just taken place in the city of L'Aquila. Conversation also focused around the peace process in the Middle East, on which there was general agreement, and other regional situations as well. Certain current issues were then considered, such as dialogue between cultures and religions, the global economic crisis and its ethical implications, food security, development aid, especially for Africa and Latin America. The issue of drug trafficking was also touched on. Finally, the importance of educating young people across the world in the value of tolerance was also highlighted. My colleague Irene Lagan tells us more.
President Obama's parting words to Pope Benedict Friday were that he looked forward to future strong relations between the United States and the Holy See. Pope Benedict told the president he would pray for him.
We look forward to a very strong relationship between our
countries. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
The police presence has been tight around the Vatican this week, as heads of state and government took advantage of the Group of Eight summit in L'Aquila, central Italy, to seek audiences with Pope Benedict. But none was as anticipated as this first encounter between the Pope and the American leader. The president arrived shortly after 4 p.m. local time in a motorcade direct from the G8 summit high in the central Apennines to the St. Damaso courtyard below the papal apartments, where an honor guard of the Swiss Guard and the papal household awaited him, led by Monsignor James Harvey. After a brief meeting with the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, he was led to the ornate papal throne room where Pope Benedict was waiting to greet him.
Thank you so much. It's a great honor for me. Thank you.
While pictures were being taken at the start of the meeting, the Pope immediately asked President Obama about the summit, to which the President replied, "It was very productive, particularly today." Doors were then closed to the outside world while the Pope and the President retired for private discussions lasting more than 20 minutes. Emerging from their talks, the Pope and President Obama posed for photographs while the President presented the First Lady and members of his staff.
This is Dennis McDonough. His brother is a priest.
Gifts were then exchanged. The U.S. President presented the Holy Father with a stole originally belonging to St. John Neumann, while the Pope in turn presented President Obama a copy of his encyclical. Earlier, First Lady Michelle Obama and their children Malia and Sasha had been given a private tour of St. Peter's Basilica and the Sistine Chapel. At shortly after 5 p.m., the presidential family took their leave of the Pope and the Apostolic Palace, bound for Ghana, Africa. I'm Irene Lagan.
And my thanks there go to Irene Lagan for bringing us this report. Earlier in the day, Irene went and called on American journalist and well-known author John Allen, who, as we know, is an expert on all things Vatican. Let's listen to an excerpt from this conversation.
This meeting is particularly important, of course, because we are still at the initial stages of a new administration in the United States, an administration that seems full of promise in so many ways from a Catholic point of view on issues of economic justice, many of the same issues the Holy Father just raised in his encyclical Caritas in Veritate, promise in terms of international relations, particularly a new opening to the Islamic world, much of what President Obama said in his June 4th speech in Cairo. Picked up upon points that the Holy Father himself made when he was in the Holy Land in late May. But an administration that is also very challenging from a Catholic point of view on a whole range of other issues, particularly, of course, the life issues. And so precisely because there is so much promise and so much peril in some ways about this administration, I think this meeting takes on a kind of special significance.
What do you see as points of convergence or cooperation between the Obama administration and the Holy See that would be possible fruits of this meeting?
In terms of areas where there do seem to be a kind of meeting of minds, two that probably would be most topical. One would be the whole area of economic justice, trying to make sure that the restructuring of the global economy in the wake of the current crisis isn't just a matter of kind of technical quick fixes, but involves a kind of deep rethinking of the premises of economic life to make sure that the economy serves the welfare of the whole human community, and in particular, of course, the welfare of the poor and the vulnerable. I think another area would be trying to open a new chapter in the relationship between the West and the Islamic world. This is, in many ways, has become Benedict XVI's most important interfaith priority. While he was in Jordan, he talked about trying to put together what he called an alliance of civilizations between Islam and the West. And I think he clearly recognizes that in order to do that, some aspects of Western foreign policy, and particularly American foreign policy, have to change. And in some of the things that President Obama has either done or promised to do in that regard, I think strike the Vatican as quite promising.
And my thanks there go to John Allen, speaking there to Irene Lagan. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, I'd like to bring you further insight as to Pope Benedict XVI's much-awaited third encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, or Charity in Truth, which was released on Tuesday this week in the course of a press conference here in the Vatican. In an effort then to find out more about this social encyclical, I went to call on a Dominican sister who also happens to be Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome. Her name is Sister Helen Alford. Let's listen. Sister Helen, can you tell me a little bit about your formation? Is it in economics?
Well, originally I studied engineering, but as part of that we had to do courses on microeconomics and business management. And that's really how I got into the whole field of social teaching, actually, because I got interested in human work within the business sphere, especially in manufacturing, where you had these very technical systems. And there were people writing at the time when I was doing my PhD on this whole idea of recovering an earlier form of technical development, which some people have called biotechnics before there was biotechnology around. Now it's usually called human-centered technology. And the basic idea is that you can basically design machines in one of two ways. Either you put the machine at the center of the process, and therefore you try to create a production system where you have the best possible machines, and then you fit people around those machines as and when it's too expensive or too difficult to automate. Or you start the other way around, basically. You start with the people and you try to create tools which help people do their jobs better. And what we found in the Industrial Revolution is that the first form, what you might call the technocentric form, was favoured by the kind of business environment, political, social, economic environment. Even though the other form was there, you find it in the early Industrial Revolution, but it gets completely squashed by this first form. So when the profession of engineering gets going, which is well after the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, it only inherits this particular form of technological design. And what these people were saying was we have to try to expand the view of engineers and change the way they think so that they can think in this different way. It's rather like what this encyclical is trying to do with the question of economics. So that's how I've got into the whole question of social teaching and the economic issues as well.
So can you develop this aspect of the encyclical charity and truth? Of course, you're a Dominican too,
right.
So you have a particular charism which is connected to truth, apart from, and I imagine, charity as well.
Of course. No, you're quite right, yeah. Yes, those words are very, very significant for us as Dominicans. In this area, probably the most important way of thinking about truth from our tradition is the idea of natural law and natural rights, and that we all need to try to understand ever more deeply what is the good thing for human beings. And what is good means what is consonant with our nature, what allows us to develop our full potential. That's the whole thinking, really, in the Dominican tradition, influenced by St. Thomas and before, obviously, by Aristotle. People who know Aristotle will know that this kind of thinking is there too. But St. Thomas uses Aristotle in the light of the gospel to enrich our understanding about what truth means in areas like economics or politics. Or that. What does it mean in practice to try to follow truth in love in these circumstances?
Well, what does it mean? It doesn't seem to connect very much. You don't associate economics and politics with truth and charity.
Yeah. It's one of our big problems of the modern age. That on the one hand, we have tremendous developments in terms of technical developments, financial instruments, all kinds of new ideas on the technical level, but they've become disconnected from social life. And as a result, a bit like this technocentric technology we were talking about before, they all too easily become the dominant factor in our life. So people live to work. Instead of work being for life, life is for work. Instead of money being for greater intrinsic goods, it becomes the goal. And we just try to get as much money as possible and become very unhappy as a result. Now, economists and some of the people who've been working on this, whose hand you can see in this encyclical, are very aware about this, and they are trying to change their models. There's a whole area of research now in economics called happiness economics. And they're trying to understand what are the components of happiness within an economic framework. It might sound a bit funny to most people, but it's an interesting attempt on their part. They realize that economics has to connect again back to these ultimate goods, which, of course, the most important are charity and truth, as pointed out in this encyclical, but also things like human happiness would also be part of that, intrinsic goods for us. It's not a surprise that when they go out and they do these surveys around the world, that the countries that they find are the most happy in their empirical research are usually the poorer countries. I remember one time Mexico came at the top of the list. You never get a big advanced economy as one of the most happy countries in the world. You tend to find the suicide rates, for instance, are much higher in advanced economies than in poorer countries. So on the one hand, we want economic development because we don't want people dying of starvation or because they don't have access to healthcare. And that. But we also don't want this at the cost of creating people who are unhappy, who don't see the goal in life, who have lost connection with these ultimate values. And that's really what this encyclical is about. It's about connecting economics and development back to these ultimate values, the highest of which are
charity and truth.
But there are lots of others as well. And I think another, if I can just add a little rider to that, another important point about this encyclical is that it emphasizes what we might call this third sector of activity. You know, we're used to thinking in our economic and social schemes about the market and the state. So the market does certain things and the state does certain things. And this encyclical points out, as has been happening for a long time, but it's now very good that it's come so clearly into the social teaching, that there's an important third sector, which is this group of very diverse organizations, like cultural organizations that are producing education, or they're non-profits, they're non-governmental organizations, they're working on human rights, they're producing all kinds of other value in our economy that neither the state nor the market can produce. And yet they're really important in terms of connecting again.
But they're fringe component, no?
Well, they're fringe in terms of people's thinking, but I'm not sure that they're fringe in terms of their actual impact in real life. I mean, this is why that aspect of the encyclical is important, because what it will do now is focus the work of economists who are interested in social teaching on learning more about this sphere and integrating it better into the way we think about social systems and economic systems.
So really, in this encyclical, from what you're saying, there's a long-term vision. It's no longer philanthropy, almsgiving to those who are the most needy, but trying to include them rather than in the main system.
Yeah, I think there's both there, because I think we don't want to lose the fact that there are always going to be poor people in need of immediate help. But that is not the only way of helping people. The much more dignified way of helping people is to provide them with the tools where they can provide for their own development. So, you know, human dignity requires that we do that too. But then if people are in crisis or in difficulty, you know, aid and charity and that is also very important. So we don't want to negate the first, but we want to add the second.
You just mentioned the word development. That word comes up a lot in this encyclical. We hear about human and economic development, and again, development of people and peoples. This is a key word in the encyclical, isn't it?
Oh, yes, surely. Partly because the whole idea of the encyclical is to reflect, again, 40 years on this the important encyclical of Paul VI, Populorum Progressio, which had development as its key idea. So it's a re-reading of that encyclical in the light of the current circumstances and bringing in our current ideas and new ideas that can help deepen our understanding of that.
Pope dedicates a whole chapter to Populorum Progressio, in which Paul VI talked about the scandal of glaring inequalities of peoples in that encyclical. But that was in the 1960s, when words are like globalization and this current financial crisis were out of the picture. So I think people were surprised that he latched on to that particular encyclical, no? Social encyclical.
Well, yeah. That's an interesting point you make, but a bit like the way popes often, well, always, in fact, remember Rerum Novarum, which is an even older encyclical, you know, 1891, they keep going back to it. This is the same kind of idea. We go back to this idea of development because although the context in which Paul VI was writing is very different, the idea that human development should be at the centre of our social and economic thinking and that it should be connected with our faith, and that it should be seen in the light of the gospel, and that charity and truth are integrally related to it, these ideas are perennial. These are always going to be important for us, and we're going to need to be reminded about them, especially because we live in such a technically advanced society today. It's all too easy to lose the vision of these perennial values because we get so caught up with the details of these wonderful systems, which are really interesting and fascinating, but they don't have any meaning unless we connect them to these higher perennial goods.
If you enjoyed that chat with Dominican Sister Helen Alford, Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome, and are curious to listen to the second part of this interview, be sure to tune in at the same time on Monday, or as an alternative, check out our website at the same time on Monday. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. And naturally, my thanks go to Sister Helen Alford for so graciously receiving me. And now I'd like you to meet our next guest on today's programme. He's Oratorian, Father Paul Chavasse, Postulator General for the causes of his order and promoter of the cause for John Henry Newman. Father Chavasse was in Rome this week and kind enough to sit down with me in our studios here, only days after Pope Benedict XVI put this 19th century English cardinal on the path to sainthood by attributing to him a miracle. Do stay tuned. So, Father, you're the promoter of the cause for beatification of John Henry Newman.
That's right.
One of our most famous church men in England.
Indeed.
And you've been working on this cause for a while, have you?
Several years, yes. Since about the year 2000, I took it on in a formal capacity.
So did Pope Benedict's placing of John Henry Newman on the path to sainthood come as a surprise?
Well, it was a great joy. Surprise, I don't think it was, because we'd been looking forward to this and expecting it, really, for quite some time, quietly hoping. You can't presume, of course, on what the Pope is going to do, but it was an immense joy last Friday when the news reached us that the miracle had been recognised, authenticated by the Holy Father.
Tell me a little about this beatification process, when the cause started.
Yes. Well, Newman died in 1890, but it wasn't until 1958 that the cause was actually opened in a formal way by my community, the Birmingham Oratory.
And which he founded?
Which he founded in 1848. And it progressed quite slowly until the middle of the 1970s, when in the run-up to the holy year of 1975, Pope Paul VI inquired whether things were at such a stage that Newman might be beatified in that holy year. Well, of course, things weren't anywhere near ready. But that inquiry from Rome gave a stimulus for work to begin. And then under John Paul II, who was most interested in Newman, and wrote several letters to encourage us in the work that we did, it was during his pontificate that the Historical Commission completed its work in the mid-1980s, and that he was also declared venerable by John Paul II in 1991, and that, of course, recognised that Newman had lived the Christian life, the virtues of the Christian life, to an heroic degree. And that recognition in 1991 opened the way for us to look for a miracle through Newman's intercession, which would lead to his beatification.
Tell me a little bit about that miracle.
Well, the miracle, as we can now call it that, as it's been officially recognised, took place in 2001 on the Feast of the Assumption in a hospital in Boston, Massachusetts.
United States?
In the United States of America, to a permanent deacon called Jack Sullivan, a deacon of the Diocese of Boston, who'd been suffering for some time from a very crippling disease of the spine, so much so that he'd been bent double as a result of it, and his studies towards ordination as a deacon had been halted, and he couldn't do his day job, so to speak. He's a magistrate in Plymouth County Court. And he'd discovered John Henry Newman through watching a programme on EWTN, which had talked about the cause and asking people to pray for favours through Newman's intercession. So Jack thought, well, I might as well try him. And he did, and a period, quite a long period, of intensive prayer and supplication went on. And it was on that day that Jack actually was cured. And much to the astonishment of the medical authorities in Boston, but from that day to this, he's been in good health.
John Henry Newman is best remembered as a thinker, a friend, a priest. What would you say?
All of them. A writer.
Would you add anything?
Theologian.
Well, he was a scholar.
A scholar.
Perhaps he's best known as a scholar.
As that, but we shouldn't forget as well. I mean, you can't be beatified on the strength of scholarship alone. And as I mentioned a moment ago, when John Paul II recognised the virtues, the Christian virtues, that Newman had lived to an heroic degree, that was a recognition of his holiness of life, which of course is the key to it all. And one shouldn't forget either, of course, he was a devoted priest, both in the Church of England when he was Vicar of St Mary's in Oxford.
Because he was a convert.
He was a convert in 1845. And also, as a father of the oratory in Birmingham, very hard-working, took his turn doing everything all the other priests in the community did. And he combined that, of course, with educational work, founding the Catholic University in Dublin, founding the Oratory School in Birmingham, an indefatigable correspondent. We've published 32 volumes of his letters and diaries, which represent less than half, we believe, of the letters he actually wrote, as the others have got lost in the course of time. So in all sorts of ways, a most remarkable man.
And my thanks there go to Oratorian Father Paul Chavas, postulator for the causes of his order and promoter of the cause for John Henry Newman. Finally, the 11th of June marks the Feast of Saint Benedict. So to celebrate our present Pope, who took this name as Roman Pontiff, I'd like to bring you an excerpt from an archive piece of my Latin Lover series, which dates back to the beginning of the Holy Father's pontificate. Stay tuned, but watch the change of pace. Father Foster, this is the first time we've met under the new pontificate. So what words would you say in Latin for the new pontificate?
Ei gratulor et optima omnia hominor.
Meaning?
I congratulate him and I wish him all the best.
He's a bit of a Latinist, Pope Benedict XVI, from here they say.
Well, I don't know, a bit of a Latinist. I mean, his whole training was Latin. I mean, he takes it for granted, you see.
But he speaks it well, no?
Oh, yes, for sure.
Does this mean that your work is going to change?
I don't think so. I really don't think.
When the journalists heard Pope Benedict XVI speaking in Latin the day after his election in St. Peter's Basilica, they all spoke about a revival of Latin, but that's not so, is it?
John Paul II had his first speech in Latin. John Paul I had his first speech in Latin. Paul VI had his first speech in Latin, huh?
So it's tradition.
So it's tradition. It's really nothing new. The journalist said, the return of Latin. Wow, really no return of Latin.
Does he have a particular style in Latin?
I don't know yet.
You don't know yet? You haven't spoken to him yet?
No.
There's been quite a lot of Latin being used recently, as is the tradition.
Whole liturgy was in Latin. All the greetings and all that stuff were in Latin by tradition.
What are the greetings that you actually like most in Latin that have been used over the past days?
Well, I don't know. Benedicamus Domino, let us bless the Lord, to dismiss the people. Benedicamus Domino, let us bless the Lord, or...
Which is Benedictus, Benedictus.
Benedictus, there's his name, Benedictus, exactly, having been blessed. Or ite in pace, go in peace, and so forth and so on. There are all kinds of nice little things in there.
But the Annuncio Vobis, Gaudium Magnum, do you think people understand that?
Well, most people would. They would just take it for granted.
So
that everyone understands that kind of Latin, which is a dog could understand that.
I don't think so.
I think so.
How would you translate Annuncio Vobis, Gaudium Magnum?
I announce to you a great joy.
Okay, I have the speech here, Father Foster, in Latin. It was the first speech of the Holy Father the morning following his election, the speech we've been speaking about in Latin. And you say there's some mistakes in it?
Well, I mean, there are printing mistakes here.
Oh, okay.
Because I think they ran this through the scanner and the scanner couldn't read it exactly. Because I've gone through this with my students.
What would you pinpoint in this speech that is particularly interesting from a linguistic point of view?
Oh, linguistic. I don't know. Linguistic. I don't know. By the way, I wrote it. I mean, I wrote it. So I don't know. What is linguistic for me? No, it's very simple and clear, we hope.
You translated it from what?
Italian.
From Italian, yeah.
Yeah. And it should be very, very clear and simple. And most people say it's very clear and simple and runs along. And it depends on the inflection of his voice. I can hear his voice. If you pronounce it well, it's a dog could understand it.
Pope Benedict XVI. Does he speak Latin with a German accent at all?
Oh, for sure.
Yes.
Oh, real, what do you say, real square and chunky. It's chunky. Well, that's German, got it?
Uh-huh.
And even at the balcony up there, boom, boom, boom. It wasn't kind of fluidy, milky, like Italian. It was very chunky. Well, that's his language and his nature and everything else.
My thanks there go, as always, to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, currently in the United States, wishing him all the best. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.